are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Hey, your cybersecurity could not be more important in today's world. Don't get distracted from it. Behind the scenes, VMware's cybersecurity software is working overtime to ensure our virtual environments are safe and secure. DH Technologies and VMware are here to offer you a free demo of their virtualization software. Go to dhtech.com/demo to find out how to protect your organization today.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 22nd, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Kate Raworth, Donut Economics, Seven Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. We'll be talking about the mythology of the free market, what GDP misses, how did things like quality of life, social well-being, the environment get excluded from economics, and how we can redesign the discipline from the insanity of free market mythology to the sanity of distributive economics. Republicans officially declare their next phase of ruthless class warfare. The Senate has finally released its healthcare repeal bill, and it is the moral and policy obscenity you expected. Cuts in Medicaid, getting rid of Planned Parenthood, federal funding for Planned Parenthood. People with pre-existing conditions are deeply vulnerable. That protection is gone. Your health insurance, lower quality, tens of millions of people thrown off, all to subsidize tax cuts. Healthcare lobbyists saw the bill before Democrats did, and this is the next phase in the war on most Americans from the Republican Party and their donor class. Donald Trump gives voice to the Republican id again. In the primary, it was all the racism and the sexism, but now he's giving voice to what Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell would like to say. Poor people shouldn't run things. Rich people should. In fact, poor people should die if it means we can give the Koch brothers an extra couple of bucks. Saudi Arabia's palace coup. How does that affect the future of Saudi aggressive actions in the Middle East? Ongoing war crimes in Yemen as the United States supports Saudi, and Israel's intelligence chief officially extends an olive branch to Saudi Arabia. They want official relations. Saudis and Israelis have been pretty synchronized regardless. And tension in Syria, debate inside the Trump administration. After Raqqa falls and ISIS is gone, does the United States continue to amplify its campaign against Assad, potentially putting us on a collision course with Iran and Russia? Or do we step back even as the so-called peace process in Syria continues in Geneva, a peace process that excludes civil society?
No, whatever we do, it will be thoughtfully considered.
We have people reading Thucydides. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Sam is not here today, obviously. He had a family medical issue he needed to attend to. He is totally fine. Nikki is totally fine, and his children are totally fine. But he did need to attend to that. Let's get to this sound. Senator Chris Murphy is actually emerging as a very effective voice for the Democrats. And he tweeted out a little over a week ago. He said, give 90% attention to what Republicans are doing with healthcare and 10% on Russia. That's exactly right. Maybe now we need to increase it to 95%. Russia's an important organized crime story, money laundering story, and if it hurts the Trump administration's approval ratings, great. But obviously, it's not as remotely as important as tens of millions of people losing their health insurance. And this is Chris Murphy this morning. He was on Morning Joe talking with one Willie Geist And he actually is taking this critique a step further. He now sounds like some people that tweeted me.
You know, Senator, Harold Ford was talking a little bit earlier about what Democrats need to do to win elections in states like Georgia and places across the South and the Midwest. It's kind of reflective of the conversation we had after the presidential election back in November, which is that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party said we need to be more progressive. And we heard that last night and again this morning from groups like MoveOn.org. The lesson was that John Ossoff was too moderate. Do you think running for office right now in this climate as a Democrat means you ought to be more progressive or more moderate?
I think what it means is the Democrats have to be hyper-focused on an economic message that tells people that the Republican Party is all about economic growth for millionaires and billionaires, and the Democratic Party is about economic growth for everybody. And I think Robert Costa is right. The fact that we have spent so much time talking about Russia has been a distraction from what should be the clear contrast between Democrats and the Trump agenda, which is on economics. You know, when I'm back in Connecticut, I often get on a commuter bus and ride it for just an hour to talk to folks, you know, that frankly don't normally call my office or write my office. And I'll just say they are never talking about issues like Russia. They are not talking, frankly, about what's on cable news at night. They are talking about the same things, wages. They're talking about education. They're talking about public safety. And so I think Democrats have to be hyper focused on an economic contrast. And I think this.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. And look, this bill, the Senate bill, which they are calling the Better Care and Reconciliation Act of 2017, which has, of course, been planned in secret, no Democratic input, handful of white male senators from rural states. It was briefed, apparently, to healthcare lobbyists. What it will do is it has deeper long-term Medicaid cuts than the House version. It eliminates a bulk of the Affordable Care Act's taxes and offers tax credits for individuals in the insurance plans that are technically more generous than the House version. But overall, this is, especially when you look at the targeting of Medicaid, this is a massive attack, again, on tens of millions of people. It will reduce care overall. And the point is, as Sam always outlines, is that you can't do the tax giveaways for the rich that they want without devastating the social safety net. And Obamacare, for as centrist and as moderate as it was something of an expansion of the social safety net. So it needs to be destroyed. The way that connects with Ossoff, there's progressive and there's moderate or centrist or whatever, center-right. But the other problem with Ossoff was that by the end of the campaign, he wasn't talking about anything. I mean, it's one thing to run an Obama Clinton centrist campaign. If you ran an Obama Clinton centrist campaign, then you would say that this crazy woman I'm running against wants to destroy the gains that we have made within the free market healthcare system.
Hillary hugged Obama and she outperformed Ossoff. Or Obamacare, I mean.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you want to run a centrist campaign, say that I support patient protections and rights. And I want to ensure that your kid can stay on your plan. I want to ensure that pre-existing conditions are covered. And I do think in, you know, a sensible way or whatever way you want to put it in brackets, we need to have a growth in wages so that the economy works for everybody. You can put all of it in tepid, boring, third-way terminology you want, but still actually run on something. That's something worth looking. I would actually give advice to the third-ray types where it's still relevant, and it might be relevant in upscale district in Georgia. Look at campaigns that Barack Obama ran. Look at campaigns that Bill Clinton ran. Look at campaigns that Tony Blair ran, frankly. Center-right campaigns, a lot of verbiage, but they actually had pretty robust policy agendas at certain points. Not the policy agenda that I support. I want real progressive reform. But they actually were talking about something. So the failing of Ossoff wasn't just that he was, you know, to the center. That might have been the right pitch for that district. It was that by the end, he vaguely was complaining about the deficit. And then we have a campaign which, you know, goes back to, like, I asked Sam about this, like 2004 style campaigns where a Democrat's like, hey, I think we ought to work together across the aisle to cut wasteful spending. And the Republican's like, you're an Al-Qaeda operative from San Francisco. And that is never going to work. So, that, and now it's on the table. even with all of the pressure, even with all of the danger in different districts, the town hall meetings, which they're going to shut down on, Republicans are ready to do this and be really clear. Murkowski, she votes for it. She's lying about Planned Parenthood. Portman's lying about Medicaid expansion if he votes for it. People like McCain, who posture in public and care about a transparent process, just like Chris Murphy said yesterday, they're shedding crocodile tears. They're lying. They love that this is secret and opaque. And this is the game. They need to put your life in jeopardy and probably cause tens of thousands of premature deaths to subsidize a tax cut. That's the purpose of Republican politics. And frankly, you don't have to be all that much to the left to, at the very least, not be a predator or sociopath and run clearly on that. As Tom Perez would say,
they don't give a shit.
And he's right. We will be right back with Kate Raworth on the Majority Report.
Roll up in the club. All eyes on me. All eyes on me.
You know what? I bet you got it twisted. You don't know who to trust. So many player hating, trying to sound like us. Say they ready for the funk, but I don't think they know it. Straight to the depths of hell is where them cowards going. Well, are you still down? Follow when you see me and let these devils suck. For the day they finally free me, I got a caravan and every time we ride.
Joining us now is Kate Raworth. She's the author of Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. The bell is ringing for it. Kate, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
So, Kate, I want to start. You do a lot of dismantling of like received wisdom and mythology of economics. One of the things I like about your book is you actually get us back to the roots of what the purpose of economics was before it became this sort of very self-regarding quantitative discipline. What is the foundation of economics as a system?
What a great starting question. So let's go back to ancient Greek. Economics comes from two words, ekos and nomos, which means the household and its management. So I think it's a beautiful concept. Economics means the management of our household. And when Xenophon in ancient Greece first wrote a pamphlet called The Economist, he was actually writing about the question of how should somebody manage his estate, his personal household, his fields, his wine, his cloth. Should he trust his wife to be in charge of the affairs? How should he manage his slaves? All the things that occupied a wealthy Greek aristocrat. That was the original concept of economics. And it was only 2,000 years later that Adam Smith, who we think of as the founder, father of economics, actually raised the notion of economics from the household to the nation state and asked, how is it that one nation can be thriving while another is stagnating? I believe that we need to reclaim the name of economics from what it's become, a very dried academic discipline, and take it back to these roots of household management, because today ours is the era of the planetary household. And our challenge is to manage this extraordinary living planet in the interests of all of its inhabitants. So to me, that's what 21st century economics is, and nothing could be more exciting than that.
So there's a number of different ways in which the mythology we're living under, and I use that word very specifically, so maybe actually before we get to the sort of specifics of it, we still, most people in this audience are going to be very comfortable with the notion that economics is not, it's not 3 + 3 = 6. It's a social science, it's a humanities, it's something that is created and designed like any other social system. But there's still a lot of people, including people at the highest reaches of government and in the corporate sector, who still talk about free markets as if they're kind of magical religious things that exist in vacuums, and we also need to submit to them, almost like we're sacrificing to the gods. I mean, there's a couple of different examples in the news right now. I mean, I was just talking before you came on about this really kind of unbelievable assault that Republicans are waging in this country against even, you know, the kind of modest progress of Obamacare. You saw the tragedy in London where you are at Grenfell Tower. We have a woman who hopefully you haven't heard of or had the misfortune of encountering in the United States named Meghan McArdle, who, you know, wrote this sort of long meandering, like, well, you don't know, you never know. I mean, installing sprinkler systems is good, but there's costs and benefits and something about speeding to work or not speeding to work. And all of a sudden it was this kind of bizarre indirect justification of not taking safety precautions, again, because of this religious entity of the free market. Can you explain why there is no such thing and how we actually design economies, free market or otherwise?
Great. So whenever I hear somebody talking about the free market, I tug on their sleeve and I say, please, please take me there. Because I have never been to somewhere with a free market. It's a completely false construct. Every market, every place where people exchange goods and services in exchange for money is embedded within society and the trust of society that we trust what this stuff money is that we're exchanging between us. It's embedded within social rules. It's embedded with laws, norms, and regulations. There is no such thing as the free market. But I like your idea that this is a mythology that's grown up. And I think of it not quite as a mythology, although I think that works, but I think of it as a fake physics. Mm-hmm. Because it was back in the 1870s, a small bunch of economists got together. And to be quite honest, they wanted to impress their dads. They wanted to make economics, which is their chosen discipline, a science as reputable as physics. They wanted to make their dads proud and show that they could turn it into a mathematized science. And in order to do that, they turned to the science of the day, which was Newtonian physics. And if you read the work of founding fathers of neoclassical economics, such as William Stanley Jevons, he takes Newtonian insights into the physical laws of motion, and he tries by direct analogy to show that this is how economies work. So he'll say, just as gravity pulls a moving object to rest, so prices and our will in the market pull those markets into equilibrium. And think of the language we talk about markets. We talk about market forces, market mechanisms, as if it's this machine that works in its own way, and no mere human can get in the way of that working. The real pernicious effect, I think, of this desire to be like physics is that the economists wanted to discover their own equivalent to Newton's physical laws of motion, and they searched for economic laws of motion. And it's this inheritance of this fake physics that leads economics to be spoken of in a way that this is how the mechanism works, this is how economies work, and humans have to adapt and get in line with that and adapt their lives to fit the workings of the market. It is a myth because economics is nothing like Newtonian physics. It's the wrong kind of science, and we've got to move on.
There's a couple of other threads on the foundations of the crisis we're in today, which is driven by this fake physics. There's GDP and how we measure growth or not growth. Then there's also in some ways, being a little bit unfair to Adam Smith, who you actually say was a much more kind of perceptive moral writer than just this kind of one-dimensional character. So can you talk about the Adam Smith thread and the GDP thread, which are kind of these other important points that got us to where we are today?
Yeah, let's start with Adam Smith, because Adam Smith was the person who first began to draw up the portrait of humanity, which has become the selfie at the heart of modern economic theory, the picture of ourselves, who we tell ourselves we are. And Smith, I think, has a really ill-deserved reputation in economic theory because only a tiny slice of his work has been taken and amplified and remembered. Smith understood that self-interest, the self-interest of the individual, is a very effective force for making markets work. People will get something at it. You know, if I can buy two things and one is cheaper than the other, I might go for the one that's cheaper than the other. I'll try to save costs. I'll try to save time. It's part of human ingenuity. So self-interest is a very powerful trait for making markets work. But he equally recognized that our interest in others is essential for making society work. And he said our traits such as generosity, public spirit, sense of justice, our compassion, our sympathy, what we would say empathy today. He says these are the traits of humanity that are most useful to others. So Smith had a very nuanced picture of humanity. He understood that we are, as David Hume would say, we each of us have something of the serpent and something of the dove. Mm-hmm. He understood that tension in human nature. But when economists came along and they wanted to create this model of economics, they wanted to make it more like physics and whittle it down to something that you could reduce to the individual atom, and humanity was that atom. They plucked out merely that trait of self-interest. So John Stuart Mill, brilliant philosopher, I think he made a bit of a mistake when he said, in political economy, we take not the whole of man's nature, nor the whole of man's conduct in society, but we take him only as a being who desires to possess wealth. Right there, the DNA of who we apparently are was sealed. We apparently, in economics, are beings who desire to possess wealth. And then they started to add to this caricature, oh, we hate work. We love luxury. Apparently, we know the price of everything. We have sort of a omniscient knowledge of all prices in all shops, past and future.
That's hedonistic calculators.
We are. We're hedonistic calculators. So in my book, I said, look, this character of rational economic man, he's never actually depicted in the textbooks, but if he were, he'd have to be drawn as a man, because he always is a man,
right.
He's standing alone, he's got money in his hand, ego in his heart, a calculator in his head, and nature at his feet. And the real problem with this character is not just how absurdly narrow a portrait of us he is, it's what looking at him does to us. Because this is one of the most fascinating things I learned as I was writing the book, Donut Economics, is that the more that students learn about rational economic man, the more they come to value his traits. The more that economic students go from year one, two, three, the more they give regard to self-interest as a trait, the less time they have for altruism, compassion, and caring for others. So on being told that he is like us, we actually become more like him. He changes who we become. And this is an extraordinary responsibility for any academic discipline that claims to tell us who we are. Because who we tell ourselves we are shapes who we become. We literally nurture our nature. An economic student don't want to be the mug. If they grow up learning a theory that says, well, humans are essentially self-interested, well, they're going to go out and be self-interested. Otherwise, they're the one who gets, you know, shafted by society because everybody else has got self-interest. It generates a really narrow version of who we are. So we need a new portrait of humanity at the heart of economics. And I think it's the most important portrait that's going to be commissioned this century. It is, of course, underway. We've got neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, sociologists, anthropologists, political scientists, economists, all adding to the preliminary sketches of this new character. Because we realize we're not merely self-interested. We're actually what's called conditional reciprocators, tit for tat. You cooperate with me, I'll cooperate with you. You defect and you cheat me, I will punish you. I'll eject you from the group. We are not isolated. We're deeply interdependent and all dependent on the unpaid caring work of our parents in raising us and our care for our partners, our own parents. So we're a deeply dependent social species. And we're not dominant over nature. We don't stand at the top of some tree of life looking down upon all that we command. We are embedded within the web of life and deeply dependent upon it. And the sooner we realize that, the far, far earlier and greater we'll give a chance to ourselves of thriving this century. All 10 billion of us, we have to learn to thrive together. And who we tell ourselves we are shapes who we become and will really significantly shape our chance of doing that.
So I want to get to, it's this fascinating, I want to get to GDP and then I want to get to the donut and how we can actually do this thriving. But first I want to kind of put three different authors that I think of when I read your work and as we're talking, who I think, you know, in different ways had premonitions of what you're talking about. So one, obviously, and there's a big resurgence right now, and in some ways I think, you know, some of the work that we do in a popularizing sense is that at the very least there's a resurgence that, like, people need to actually read Marx as an example because it's an alternative account of power dynamics. So what people were trying to naturalize as these forces that are just inevitable and physical, like you're saying, which is discredited, obviously. But there's this whole other narrative that, of course, one's always trying to, you know, naturalize dominance and naturalize inequality and unfairness. And that's Marx's account. Then I also think of a guy like E.F. Schumacher writing about small is beautiful and saying that, a Buddhist economics, which is the terminology he used, includes finding purpose and meaning in work. What does this do for ecology? What does this do for community? And then there's a woman, Rianne Eisler, who kind of talked about dominator versus cooperative societies as another model that had to do with the kind of like gendered roles of all of this. I'm just wondering if you could think of those kind of three streams, the power, the meaning, and the gender.
Oh, wow. Well, that's fantastic that you bring all of those in, because all of those are precisely what's missing from mainstream neoclassical economics. If you pick up a neoclassical textbook and look up the word power, if it's in the index at all, it's going to be talking about electricity sector reform. That's all. Because right. they were determined to annihilate the idea of power from the analysis. And the only thing you need to worry about is if the state gets too powerful, because then the state will take over the market. And that's why we need to roll back the state. Milton Friedman was brilliant at telling this story. But neoclassical economics also misses the unpaid caring work of parents. And it's particularly women who've traditionally done this work. All that cooking, washing, sweeping, cleaning, raising the kids, doing it all again tomorrow, and then doing it for your parents as they grow older. It's so much of where our well-being comes from. And yet it's largely ignored in mainstream economics because there's no money passing hands, and the economics got obsessed with markets as if these were the only means by which we produce and distribute goods and services we value. It's not at all the case. So, and then E.F. Schumacher writing beautifully about purpose. I think the character of Rational Economic Man we're talking about, I said he was depicted as work-hating. He'll always avoid work. Actually, that's quite a false image of who we are. Rather than simply work-hating, we are purpose-seeking. And the lucky ones are those who find that their work and purpose come together. For many people, they don't come together, but then they go and pursue that purpose somewhere else in their life. They may volunteer. They may find purpose through raising their children. They may find their purpose outside of the market economy. Right. There's a distinction between being work-hating and purpose-seeking. So yes, power, purpose, and unpaid care work traditionally done by women, hugely important to bring into a 21st century story, which is precisely what I've tried to do in my book by starting economics not with the theory of markets and that the idea that they're in equilibrium and then how everything must fall in line to make markets work and produce growth, but rather start with the fundamental values of human well-being and ask what kind of economic system would generate those, what kind of economic mindset will give us the best chance of getting there. And you talked about growth. Let's go to growth, because let's just start with the fundamentals, growth. What we're really talking about is the increase in GDP, gross domestic product, which is the value of goods and services sold in an economy in, say, a year. And what shows up in GDP is things that are produced and sold by the market. Every time I buy an ice cream or get my hair cut at the hairdresser's or buy a new car or buy a ticket for the subway. And what shows up in government expenditure, government money spent on teachers, on road lighting, on road building, on defense, all of these show up in GDP. It's a funny old bag of things to say that just because GDP is going up, then the welfare is increasing. I mean, it'd be a bit like a policeman coming to your neighborhood, knocking on your door and saying, I just want you to know there's an increase of activity in your neighborhood. Well, you'd really want to know what kind of activity that was, right? Is that kids having a great time in the street, or is this drug dealers around the corner? So it's not enough just to know that there's more goods and services being sold. What are they? Is it fracking and tar sands and more fossil fuel exploitation? Or, no, it's billions of dollars being spent investing in solar energy capacity so we can make ourselves free from the fossil fuels and turn to the sun, our daily income of energy. Is that money that's being generated through a house price bubble and going off into the pockets of the already wealthy, increasing the value of the 1%? Or is it actually money that's circulating in communities that have had high rates of unemployment and are beginning to establish co-ops and employee-owned enterprises and bringing life back into the heart of their own communities? It really matters where that money is being generated and what that GDP is adding value to. But also, there's a lot of value going on outside the market. It'll never show up in the market. If I spend a day at home with my kids, reading to them, raising them as good citizens, that doesn't show up in any GDP value. If you volunteer, if you go on a march because your political values are being violated and you stand for that and you with tens of thousands of people are marching and you feel fantastic and powerful as a citizen, well, that doesn't show up. So many of the things we value and care for to do with power, to do with purpose, and to do with unpaid care of parents, these don't show up in GDP. So it's really not a good metric. It may have been quite a good metric last century when it was first invented in the 1940s, calming out of the Depression, getting markets moving again, government reinvesting money. It had quite a good correlation going hand in hand with raising people's incomes and so they can begin to buy the beginnings of consumer goods that, you know, lead to the kind of wealth lifestyles of the 1950s, 1960s. But today we've gone far beyond that. And that correlation has strongly broken down as we realize that the industries we've created are degrading and running down the planet. and that the returns from the industries we've created, because of the way they're owned and structured, and because of the financial sector, a lot of the returns are being siphoned off to the already wealthy. So GDP is running down our planet and ending up in the pockets of very few. It's by no means a good enough measure of what we actually want.
Right. And all of those second order mythologies that arise of it, like, well, you have a lot of inequality in the beginning, but then it gradually flattens out. Again, like as if these things just sort of happen through some type of magical natural process. So as a result of the pseudophysics of economics, we have this inequality crisis, this climate crisis. We also have maps of ourselves and our perception of ourselves as who we are and what we're capable of, which are very limiting and socially stifling. Mm-hmm. You've done this really great holistic map. And on the contrast, there is the donut. What's the donut? How do we get there? Sounds good.
Sounds good. Now, first of all, you don't have to go out and eat a lot of donuts. This may be the good one for GDP, donut though. That actually turns out to be. Well, you might make them at home. You never know.
Oh, there you go.
It's the one donut that might turn out to be good for us. So imagine a donut, the kind you guys eat in the U.S., with a hole in the middle. This is the shape, I believe, of the compass we need to guide us in the 21st century. So in that hole in the middle of the donut is a place where people in countries rich and poor are falling short on life's essentials. It's a place where people don't have the resources they need to have enough food or water or decent housing, healthcare, good education, political voice. They don't have access to transport networks, internet networks that give them the ability to lead lives of dignity and opportunity and community. So we want to get everybody in the world out of the hole in the middle of the donut, then into the juicy donut itself. But our 21st century challenge is that we realize we also can't go beyond the donut's outer crust, because there we are putting so much pressure on this incredible planet that we are beginning to kick it out of kilter. Mm-hmm. We are causing climate change, creating a hole in the ozone layer, acidifying our oceans, converting far too much of the Earth's land for human use, creating biodiversity loss, air, chemical pollution. So we need to come back within the donut's outer crust. So therein lies the challenge. How do we get everybody in the world out of the middle of the hole, but come back within the crust? Because at the moment, many millions of people live in that hole in the donut. They don't have enough food. They don't have access to healthcare. Don't get a good education. Don't have decent housing. Don't have political voice. So many millions of people are falling short on life's essentials. And yet we've already overshot many of what we can call the planetary boundaries, these boundaries of pressure. We're way over on climate change. We're way over on biodiversity loss, on converting land surface to human use. And we're way over on fertilizer use, which is leaching out into lakes and rivers and killing off sea life. So, and we don't even know where we are on air and chemical pollution. We could be over on those two. So we have started the 21st century in an extraordinary place. Millions of people can't meet their most basic needs. And we are already collectively living beyond the means of the planet. How the heck do we come back within the means of the planet and meet the needs of all? To me, this is the 21st century challenge. It is the challenge that our children's grandchildren will remember us for, not where I'm sitting in the UK. They won't remember us for Brexit. I believe they won't even remember the US for Trump. They won't remember for a wall that he threatens to build. They will remember our generation as a generation that could have done something about it. And the question is, are we going to be the generation that does something about it or not? Right now, we're going to go down in history as the era of reckless overshoot. And we still just have a chance to turn that inheritance around. Can we? Will we? I believe that a new economic mindset is crucial if we're going to do that. It's not the whole answer, but it's crucial. Because what drives me mad is that young people going to university today, those 18, 19-year-olds who see the state of the world, they see the degradation of the living world, they see the inequality in their societies, they want to be equipped with the public policy tools to do something about it. So like anybody reasonable would say, I need to learn some economics, right? I need to help manage this household. But these policymakers of 2050 are being taught economics from the textbooks of 1950. Mm-hmm. And those in turn are based on theories from 1850 when people were trying to make economics look like Newtonian physics. So this is a disaster, and it also is deeply selling the next generation of thinkers short on their right to a decent education. So my passion is to rewrite economics so it's fit for this new generation of thinkers and household managers who are coming through, because we really need them to be equipped with the best ideas if they're going to have even half a chance of bringing humanity into the donut space and just space.
So as a final question, it's been clear throughout, you're talking about educating people into the full range of human capacities and traits, and that means thinking about ourselves in a much broader way than this sort of silly neoclassical model in economics, which also has leached out into many other fields, unfortunately. It's its own kind of form of acidification of intellectual discourse. What would you be telling in this new curriculum, this new model for students and also for governments? What does the kind of holistic model look like functionally, as a final question?
Okay. What does it look like functionally? First of all, we recognize that the economy is embedded within society and embedded within the living world. It's a subsystem. It's utterly dependent. So you can't just study economics, right, as if this was a self-contained discipline. We need to be wide-minded social scientists and be humble and respect what we can learn from ecology. We need to understand the functioning of the living world if we're to have a chance of managing mankind's life within it. We need to understand our dependence on each other as societies. But there are many, many things that, as you said, governments can do, as well as students thinking in terms of practical policies. So right off the bat, stop taxing labor and start taxing the use of resources. Because there's an absurdity today that governments tax companies for hiring people. It's like penalizing them for employing people, but subsidizing them for using resources, whether it's in terms of subsidizing them for buying new capital equipment and depreciating it, or for extremely subsidized use of fossil fuels, which the planet cannot remotely afford. So this is crazy. We should tax things that are bad, not things that are good. Shift taxes from labor to resource use, and you'll begin immediately to turn around market behavior, because markets are great at responding to prices. Start to employ more people and use fewer resources, and we'll begin to create an economy that is regenerative by design, where we work with the living processes of the earth. But secondly, we need to create an economic mindset for students and also in government and in business, where we create an economy that's not just regenerative by design, but also distributive by design. Right. By that, I mean value created is shared far more equitably with all of those who help create it. Think employee-owned company. Think cooperative.
Yep.
In terms of ideas, think putting ideas in the Creative Commons rather than under patents and intellectual property rights. These are everyday examples of distributive design. So for me, at the heart of the 21st century economy is the principles. Let's be regenerative by design, be distributive by design. Whether the economy grows or not becomes a response to that. And let's recognize the full richness of human capability, because we are the greatest resource we have on our team, and we better harness it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good response. And my last thought is there's something incredible specifically about embarking. The internet and the tech economy is something that is completely made up entirely. And we get to decide how it's governed, what we do with it, and how it works. And we're creating systems of inequality, tremendous inequality in terms of the rewards of those platforms, and also playing all sorts of different games with restrictive intellectual capital and intellectual property. So we're introducing false scarcity to something that actually, other than literally the material of manufacturing the hardware, has no material limits. And then we still treat the ecology as if, there's the infinite resource. So we're shrinking the boundaries of what is humanly possible when we actually could let our imaginations roam. And then when it comes to the actual physical limits, we're still just whatever, we got it. It's bizarre.
Yes. And as soon as we realize we've designed the internet, it's entirely our own construct, take that very same insight and look at money. It's entirely a construct that we have designed. We've decided it bears interest, that banks can issue it, what it can be used for. Take business. It's an entirely a construct we've created about how a company is incorporated, what its purpose is, what it's liable for. All of these things are a question of design. And that's what makes me realize that 21st century physics, 21st century economics is going to drop the fake physics. Economists are not like physicists. They're designers.
Right.
And then it becomes a really exciting question. How do you design an economy to be regenerative and distributive and to help us get into the donut? That is the design question. And if the 21st century economist is excited by that, then we've got a starter here. We've got half a chance.
Kate Raworth, Donut Economics, 7 Ways to Think Like a 21st Century Economist. It's a great book. I really, really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. We are going to get to the fun half. Lots of sound. Lots of activity. Lots of Republicans trying to kill you. But also lots of fun. Lots of Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia is fun for me. No, Saudi Arabia is not particularly fun. All right. And your calls, 646-257-3920. The IMs are open. Come on, you know where the fun is. The fun is with you, our partners in the show experience. We'll see you in the fun half.
All the time, she said, no, 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 no. Like to speak my mind. She said, no, 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 no. And I know her time's not free. She didn't waste none on me. Situation sad.